Hello, Peter Moore here. A few quick words before we begin. I promise I won't keep you long. First of all, thank you for the lovely feedback you've been sending us about last week's two episodes. We're really happy to get it, of course. If you are enjoying the podcast, we'd be incredibly grateful if you'd spare a moment of your time to leave us a five-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It's pretty much the best way that we have of reaching more listeners. In compensation for your kindness, though, we do have two new episodes for you today, and this is the first of them. It's an absolute treat. Without further ado, welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. The early 1960s in this episode, a time when Britain seemed revitalised after the drab post-war years, a time when anything seemed possible. Leading the charge of the new cultural movement, of course, was a band from Liverpool called The Beatles. Today's guest is a prolific, prize-winning and much-loved journalist and humorist. Craig Brown is known for his parodies in Private Eye and for writing more than a dozen books. His latest, 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time, is just out. According to the Sunday Times, it is a ridiculously enjoyable treat. Also a ridiculously enjoyable treat is this conversation between Craig and Artemis. Please excuse the occasional burst of doodling underneath the microphone from Craig. You'll just have to imagine him scribbling away like a latter-day John Lennon. Otherwise, enjoy.
So thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time, Craig.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I thought we could start by, I could just ask you some questions about your book, 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time, because I'd really like to know how, you know, there are so many books about the Beatles out there. It feels like quite a brave endeavour to write a new one.
Yes, I saw somewhere that there were 733 books, so mine is the 734th. They tend to be either very dogged, telling you almost what they did every minute of their lives, if they drive in a car, telling you what the registration number of the car is and that kind of thing. So every detail, so Proustian detail. Or they're very, very niche. Like I've got a book called The Beatles in Coventry. Or I've got the autobiography of the Beatles hairdresser, Leslie Cavendish.
Wow.
That kind of thing. But I thought that there was nothing which kind of combined autobiography, history, kind of random thoughts, little intellectual essays, parallel histories, you know, sort of what if such and such hadn't happened. And I think also there was a slight sense of humour lacking about the Beatles, about the way people have written about the Beatles.
Yeah.
And the Beatles were, you know, certainly in the first few years, they had great fun and they were funny. So I think it's appropriate to do a funny book. And it's also appropriate when they go slightly off the rails to be slightly more cynically humorous.
Yeah.
I thought there was something to be done there. And I was worried that the Beatles nerds, who there are hundreds of people who, you know, argue about the tiniest detail. So I thought they wouldn't enjoy the book, but they there doesn't seem to be any major criticism of it.
Good. they've given you, granted you mercy on this occasion.
I think so.
I wanted to actually ask you about the chapter in which you discuss John is meant to have punched someone at a party. Or he has,
oh, yes.
He did punch someone at a party. And there are all, you run through all of the different versions of this story, both from people who were there or people who heard it secondhand, and then all of the biographies, really thoroughly going through exactly, in a very funny way, exactly, you know, who says exactly what the assault was like and what it was caused by and what was the aftermath and that kind of thing, to the point where you even make a table laying it all down. And I
yes.
thought... Yeah,
oh, yeah, sorry.
I was just going to say, I thought it was, A, it's really funny, but it's kind of made me think, well, that is what history is.
Well, what happened in probably, I think it was probably 1962 or 63, John beating up this disc jockey in Liverpool. If people can't even get things accurately that recently, then how can you possibly think that, you know, Henry VIII's court or something, or further back in medieval times? How can you get any degree of accuracy? And it's very, I mean, historians always say, oh, well, you know, written sources, but the written source is very likely to have made it up or have got the wrong idea. I mean, a lot of these people who were at the party and witnessed the beating up, you know, they spoke pretty quickly after it, and they all had a different idea. So they weren't just lying, it was just misreading of the situation.
And people's relationship with the Beatles is so emotive that you feel like you believe the interpretation that suits what you think, what you want to believe about
yes.
John Lennon.
Yes, so if you think John is marvellous, you make the injuries he did to this disc jockey, who was called Bob Wooler, you make them very minor. And if you don't like John, you make them major. There's a particularly virulently anti-John biographer called Albert Goldman. He virtually had Bob Wooler as dead on the ground. And if you check anything in the Bob Wooler book, which was the first huge book about John Lennon, it's not accurate.
Really? What was it? Why did he have such a vendetta against John?
I think he was one of those biographers, like another one is Kitty Kelly. American biographers tend to be either very honest, very fact-checky, slightly dry, or completely off the rails, just putting in whatever they want.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be much in between. I think English biography is more, it's not necessarily knockabout, but it's slightly more lively.
Were there any biographies that you came, or generally books about the Beatles that you came across while you were researching, that any avid Beatle fan listeners can make sure they go and read after they've obviously read your one?
Well, I like first person ones. So there are quite a lot of, most of them would be ghost written, but I can't see anything wrong with ghost written books. It's just a form of oral history, if they're done well. There's one by John's best friend from school, who remained his a kind of constant friend through his life, called Pete Shotton.
Mm.
And that gives a very vivid picture of them as 10-year-old kind of. They were mad on the Just William books. And you can see I have a chapter on the influence of Just William on John Lennon's life. And so I'd say the Pete Shotton book.
We're going to have to focus in on just one year today.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests. If you could travel back in time to any year in history, what year would it be?
The year I've chosen is 1963, which you could say is barely history. I was born in 1957, so I was 6 years old. But I'm interested in the age of sort of five or six for anyone, because I think it's when you first become aware of news beyond the family and beyond the village. And so it's the first year that I remember, distinct things.
Do you remember hearing about the Beatles?
Yes, I think it must have been at the end of 1963 that at Christmas that we were, my brothers and I were given Beatles wigs for Christmas. It can't have been the main, I hope it wasn't our main Christmas present, because they weren't even real wigs. They were made out of plastic and they cut into your, if you moved your head slightly, you'd feel your ear being sort of pierced.
Yeah.
We were aware of the Beatles, and I think everyone was aware of the Beatles. It was, and as everyone went on about their hair, and even though it now looks, almost bizarrely short, I remember the wigs. I don't have any other distinct memory of the Beatles.
It's amazing to think how quickly, even then, they were being turned into, like, that kind of really tacky merchandise was already being seized upon as a, like, something that could be done out of their fame.
I discovered while sort of researching Brian Epstein, their manager, that it took Brian Epstein completely by surprise. That kind of merchandising hadn't been done before, or not in such a big way. And though Brian Epstein was a very good manager and an honest man, he completely misjudged that, and he sold, I don't think I put it into the book because it was too complicated, but basically he sold the rights to the merchandising for virtually nothing. He could have got sort of 70% and he got sort of 2% or something. And that was the only big mistake he made as their manager. You know, in America in particular, by 1964, they were a year later to become famous in America. They were selling things like air that the Beatles had breathed, or
really?
after they'd stayed in a hotel, they cut up all the sheets and sold them in square inches. There's something in the book that Beatles wigs at one point, when they were over there in 1964, they were importing sort of 50,000 to New York every day. I mean, or perhaps it was every week. So I think George Martin said, when their producer, when he was in New York, he looked out of a car window and saw quite ordinary businessmen wearing Beatles wigs. So it was the year of merchandising.
That's interesting. Well, we're going to not just talk about the Beatles today, because I know the first scene that you've chosen to visit in 1963 is the Great Train Robbery in yes. August. So would you like to tell us a bit about where you'd like to be in the story of the Great Train Robbery?
Yes. Well, I remember the Great Train Robbery is the first really exciting story that I became aware of in the papers. And I remember reading all the papers avidly to see more and more about the train robbery. And excitingly for me as a six-year-old, they dumped some of the money at Leith Hill near Dorking, and we lived just near Dorking.
Oh.
So £100,000 was found in at Leith Hill, where we used to go on bicycle rides and things. So I had this amazing idea that, you know, I would soon be the beneficiary of their theft. There must be more money to be found. And so that was very exciting. But basically what had happened is in August 1963, these 15 villains stopped a Royal Mail train, which was carrying what were today, it's £2.5 million in those days, which would be roughly £55 million now, in used banknotes. I think they were just going to be destroyed. So you could say it's almost a victimless crime. They stopped the train and robbed it. They did actually cosh the driver and say it wasn't entirely victimless. They got away. It was all very, very well planned, very well executed. They got away with all but 8 of the 128 sacks that there were, and they got them into a big van and scooted off, and they went to a place called Leatherslade Farm, which is about 27 miles away, and they hung out in Leatherslade Farm. They'd bought this farm a few months earlier, and that was where they were going to hang out. They managed to tune into police radio system, so they realized that the police thought they were kind of in the area. The police thought they were within an hour radius of the crime, and so they then decided eventually to scoot away before they had planned to, and they left behind in Leatherslade things like 34 loo rolls, and so it proved that they were going to be there for a long time. They'd originally planned. Anyway, where I'd like to be in 1963 is at Leatherslade Farm playing Monopoly with them, because they played Monopoly. Obviously, these 15 rogues had to pass the time in some way. They couldn't go outside at all, or they'd be recognised. And so they played Monopoly, but with real money, because they had all this real money. and actually now I probably could, Mr. Rich, I could play Monopoly just about with real money, because you can buy things, you know, most expensive is Mayfair for £400. Well, I mean, I suppose it would be a push to get a complete set of all the properties, but anyway, plus hotels and things. But obviously in those days, £400 would have been far more. So that would have been exciting, I think. And then with people listening to the police radios and that air of tension, I probably wouldn't have liked their company, actually. I mean, they were quite thuggy characters. And I don't think they'd have liked me. I'd like to have been a fly on the wall rather than a participant. I'm sure they argued about, you know, who owed what money to who in the Monopoly game.
Their characters is something that I wanted to ask you about, because I was reading about how people at the time, before they were caught, the press would ask people on the street, what do you think about this, the Great Train Robbery? And they'd kind of be like, oh, you know, well, good on them. Like, I hope they kind of, like, they didn't feel that opposed to the idea. They kind of had a...
No, I think it was like, and of course, you know, at school we learned about Robin Hood, and there's actually a big Saturday night series of Robin Hood riding through the glen. And, you know, and they did seem a bit like Robin Hood and his merry men, sort of stealing from the rich. And, well, they didn't give to the poor, unless you classify themselves as poor. But, and there was, I did see... just recently, when I was sort of looking up about it, that actually Graham Greene, after, I'm leaping ahead, basically they were arrested, sent to prison, then two of them escaped from prison. And at the time of their escape, Graham Greene wrote the Telegraph, and he said, Am I one of a minority in feeling admiration for the skill and courage behind the great train robbery? More important, am I in a minority in being shocked by the savagery of the sentences? Mm. Because they were sentenced to 30 years in prison. I mean, wow. Amazing, really, given that there was a little bit of violence, but not much, and then it was only done by one of them.
Why do you think people felt so sympathetic towards them?
Well, I think it was because they saw them as kind of, you know, kind of lovable rogues, and that it was very, very cleverly planned. I think it was probably, you know, it was the same time as kind of Michael Caine was in those kind of films where it all sort of heist films. So I think everyone felt that it was a bit of an adventure, and it was such an outrageous amount of money.
Mm.
And obviously people like it if they're not stolen from themselves. And so I think that was the reason. Though the judge said it was a crime of sordid violence inspired by vast greed.
Mm, pretty damning stuff.
I suppose you could argue, I think saying sordid, they sort of coshed the train driver, which is bad. They always say that he died, you know, later of the injuries, but in fact he died of leukemia 7 years later. He didn't go back to work. So it was kind of GBH, but it wasn't mass murder.
To what extent do you think you could link it to, people often talk about the end of an age of deference happening in the 60s and people being more in favour of anti-establishment figures? Maybe you could say that a bit about the Beatles in some ways.
You certainly could say it about the great train robbers. I'd guess that if it had happened 10 years earlier, people would have been less sympathetic. But there was something about the kind of Ealing, it was a kind of Ealing comedy idea, I think. That was what they seemed most like. And of course, when they were on the run, I think five were on the run because some hadn't been caught anyway. That was an amazing kind of hijinks. I mean, Ronnie Biggs scaled the prison wall, jumped onto the top of a lorry, and then got to Paris, had a bit of plastic surgery, then got to Australia. Then he was almost found in Australia, and so he moved to Rio de Janeiro. And people were following the life of Ronnie Biggs right up. I mean, he then came back to Britain to die, really. This robbery kept the public enthralled, really, for 40 years. The other ones went to Mexico, and it was just, you know, people on the run is always exciting, I think.
So he evaded capture for all of his life?
Yeah, virtually. I mean, he was caught, went to prison, escaped very quickly from prison, and then he was found in Brazil, and there was a great, I think it was called Slipper of the Yard, this policeman who'd been, you know, manically trying to catch him. It got him in Brazil, but luckily for Biggs, he'd got his girlfriend pregnant, and so they couldn't extradite him because he had a son on the way.
It is a really good story. It is, there's something irresistible about it and romantic, even though you kind of know that if you looked into the details of it, they probably were all not very nice people and criminals.
Yeah, most of them had been to prison before, and they were rough types.
Yeah, I wonder if it. Well, there's so many popular TV programs nowadays, aren't there, about gangsters like Peaky Blinders and stuff like that?
Yes, yes.
I wonder
who are turned into kind of heroes, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if that trend started with the Great Train Robbery, or
yes, it could have done.
So, for your next scene, we're somewhere a lot cozier than in the like hiding out with criminals.
Yes.
Well, would you like to introduce where we are?
Well, I've, because of the Beatles and my interest in the Beatles, I've chosen to be in the end of 1963 at 57 Wimpole Street with Paul McCartney, and that's where he was living. In April 1963, the Beatles appeared at the Royal Albert Hall with an odd little assembly. I love the groups you see on the bills in those days, on the playbills. Because there's sort of such an odd mixture. But he was with Del Shannon, who did that song Runaway, Rolf Harris, who we all know about, Shane Fenton, who then became Alvin Stardust and became sort of briefly famous in the 1970s, and George Melly, the jazz singer. So it's kind of mixed bag. Anyway, this was the first concert where things had gone completely wild, really screaming, climbing on the roof of their car and blocking the way. And sent along by the Radio Times to interview the Beatles and to cover the concert was the 16-year-old actress who had been in three or four films by then, Jane Asher. And she was also famous because she was on Jukebox Jury, which was the big kind of pop show. And so the Beatles, when they took it, she was also very pretty. So they took a real interest in her. Then after the concert, they went back to a journalist's house, very small house. And John, who was quite a bully, especially in early days, started bullying her and upsetting her. Paul then sort of took her to the next door room. And they, in a very sort of sedate fashion, they sat and talked about the Canterbury Tales, which they'd both studied at school. Jane at Queen's College in Harley Street, kind of private school. Paul in Liverpool. Paul, he had a very good English teacher, and so he was interested in English literature. You had this thing after a huge Beatles concert of these two people talking about Chaucer, these two youngsters, because even Paul wasn't as young, but he was 1920. And then he dropped her off at her parents' house in Wimpole Street and asked for her phone number. Anyway, their romance began then. Before the year was out, he'd been invited by Jane's parents to go and live. He had his own room at the Ashers' house in Wimpole Street. They were a particularly interesting family, which is, I think, why one of the reasons Paul so landed on his feet. I mean, Jane Asher's attractive, nice person, and her parents were particularly interesting. Her father was a doctor, Dr. Richard Asher. He would be famous in a way, regardless of this connection, because in 1951, he'd identified and named Munchausen's syndrome.
So
he's sort of part of history, in medical history. He also wrote very funny articles for the British Medical Journal, which I really enjoyed reading, and I wasn't expecting to understand even any article in the BMJ. One of them was called "Why Are Medical Journals So Dull?" So anyway, within this environment, Paul really blossomed. The other Beatles were kind of either just married or having fun, going to nightclubs. And he rather loved this, the intelligent cultural conversations. There were also two other brothers Jane had. They played word games, and they would sort of have proper sit-down dinners and argue about sort of intellectual things. Paul remembered one argument between Dr. Asher and Peter, who was Paul's age, on when the tomato was first introduced to England. So they're very specific historical discussions. Yeah. At the same time, Margaret Asher, Jane's mother, was a music teacher, and she'd actually taught George Martin, I think it was the oboe, at the Royal College of Music. And she taught Paul to play the recorder. He could already play piano and guitar, and he played it on Fool on the Hill. But they also, you know, encouraged him to read widely. So he read Jung and Aldous Huxley and went to Pinter plays and listened to Stockhausen. So he just kind of broadened his horizons. And at the same time, it was very fruitful time for him composing. These amazing songs would just kind of pour out of him. There was a music room in the basement. And so when Margaret Asher wasn't using it, he would sit at the piano there. And he composed, just in that, there should be a plaque at Wimpole Street. And he composed, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and "I Love Her," "We Can Work It Out," "Here, There and Everywhere." And "Yesterday," I mean, famously, he woke up having dreamt the tune of "Yesterday." I mean, he just woke up with it in his head. I don't want to just be in Wimpole Street. I want to be Paul in Wimpole Street.
Yeah. And I want to be Jane.
Yeah. And it was a kind of perfect setup. And he was there for a few years, sort of 3 or 4 years. They were engaged, and then the engagement broke off. But it was a perfect time for him and very productive.
And you've touched a bit on it already, but about how fruitful his composing was, do you feel like they really had an enormous influence on him? And perhaps how did he start to maybe differ from the other three in his writing if they weren't also having that same experience that he was having?
I mean, he's discreet about it, that, unusually, these people now, neither he or Jane has ever talked about their relationship. And so I suppose he doesn't talk much about living there, other than he's always been very appreciative of the Ashers. I think John did pop round, and John and he were still composing things together. I mean, I think definitely "Yesterday" was purely Paul, but "I Want to Hold Your Hand," they wrote together. And so I think the John-Paul partnership it was always quite rivalrous in that they wanted, and that's what spurred them on. They each wanted to better the other in some way. And I think that applies to all the kind of songwriting partnerships.
I really loved
it. And maybe any artistic partnership. You're friends, but you're also rivals. And so they're always trying to top each other. And I think they never sat down to write a song without a song coming out. I mean, they could write a song in an hour or two.
Mm.
And I think also at that time, it's with other pop stars like Bob Dylan or Paul Simon, the really good ones, that they are very, very ambitious, even at that kind of hippie-ish time. When they were 16, 17 and writing songs in Liverpool, in the bedrooms in Liverpool, they would always write a new song by Lennon and McCartney, mm-hmm. as if they were already established.
Yeah.
And I think that conveys their sense of great determination to succeed.
Yeah, definitely. It is an amazing scene. I know you wrote in the book that if you could be any Beatle at any time, you'd be Paul
in,
yeah, there. I kind of completely agree. I also think that it's, maybe this is just my personal preference for Paul as a huge Beatles fan myself, but I always felt slightly resentful that John gets the reputation for being the really arty one.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because because most people, I think, tend to side with John, and especially after they broke up. There was always, they broke up, it ended in tears, at least for a time, and they would write, John would write letters to Melody Maker and New Musical Express against Paul. I mean, it's completely sort of crazy feud in public.
Mm.
In a way, you had to, like you had earlier, to choose between the Stones and the Beatles, but people had to choose between John and Paul, and that still lingered. And then, of course, after John died, he became sanctified, and Paul was seen, he's the commercial one, he's less talented, he's less passionate, he's more of a sort of showman. And I think now people are realizing how, without Paul, I think that maybe without John, Paul would have succeeded, because I think Paul has that kind of that drive, talent. But I think John was too lazy and too uncontrollable to have succeeded without Paul. That doesn't take away from John's talent, but obviously they were best together, and I don't think either was as good solo.
No,
and
I
think it was that sense of competition which became a kind of symbiotic thing.
I think people talk about the fact that Paul tends to write more ballads or more kind of commercial music as if that's somehow easier, when actually it is still very hard to write songs that are going to sell really well. That's not like
yes, and also melody. He had this amazing gift for melody, which is really at the basis of music, I think.
Yeah.
And John in New York, in the 1970s, I can't remember if I put it in the book or not, but I think Yoko actually said, after, who's not always as loyal as she sort of makes out to John, she said that he hated he'd go into smart hotels at the Plaza in New York or something like that, and the pianist, thinking to suck up, would immediately play Yesterday, and the pianists would always play a Paul song, thinking, oh, they're Lennon McCartney songs. People have only quite recently started to make the distinction between the songs by McCartney. And Lennon would be really upset by this, because basically people covered Paul's songs, lots of other artists. I mean, I think Yesterday's been covered by 2,000 different people. I think it's in the Guinness Book of Records. It's the most covered record.
Wow.
I can't remember what. I suppose people have sung Imagine or something a few times. But, John's songs haven't been covered nearly as much. I mean, maybe that doesn't mean anything, but it certainly upset John.
I wondered if we could speak a bit more broadly about what the Beatles are up to in 1963, because I know that in your book you really pivot it as a really significant moment in their career, and a kind of the ascent towards absolute stardom really happens in 1963, and also the fact that the term Beatlemania was coined in that year as well.
Yes, basically with 1963, they began 1963 in obscurity. They were playing, village halls in the Highlands, and sleep on top of one another in vans in the freezing cold, just to try and keep warm and that kind of thing. They ended it, probably the foremost famous people in Britain, and then by February 1964 or March, they'd become the foremost famous people in the world, I think, because they'd cracked America suddenly, unbelievably famous. But it did, in England, it happened less dramatically than in America, but it was still, they were on a tour with Helen Shapiro, who was then age 16, and she was a big star. And they started off sort of eighth on the bill, so they'd be almost the opening act, and they would play for 10 minutes. But by the end of the tour, which was only, 6 weeks long or something, I think they were number two, and poor Helen Shapiro's latest single had only got to sort of, 28 or 30. And they were on a tour bus with Helen Shapiro, who they got on well with, and she was obviously a nice person. And she saw this headline in one of the music papers, is Helen a has-been at 16? I'm a terrible thing. And of course she was. And actually, having been rude about John before, he was actually kind to her there, and he kind of comforted her. But it showed how dramatically their success came when it did. They'd been playing together since they first met in 1957. They played in one form of band or another. So they'd been obscure for quite long, but once fame started to kick in, it really kicked in quickly.
I also find the, the discourse surrounding the hysteria a really fascinating one, because the Elvis Presley before had inspired that kind of female hysteria, quote unquote, yes, from his fans. And it's a kind of like, I guess it's basically a sexual frenzy. That's what I find so interesting about the cultural phenomenon of Beatlemania, because it's, you imagine that you're a 14-year-old girl growing up in the 60s, and maybe you're not given any particular opportunity to express that you might want to have sex with a boy, and it might be seen as still quite taboo. And yet here is this band that you can go and see with your friends, and you can all just scream because you're so excited by them. And that's, well, it's not socially acceptable because people did write disparagingly about it, but it kind of is like an outlet for you. I always really feel like that's what's going on underneath all of the screaming, is some kind of repressed female sexuality that's looking for an avenue.
I think it is, and girls didn't really scream at the Rolling Stones, who obviously looked more like men. There was something kind of boyish about, and so I think it was probably that idea that you could go so far, but only so far with them. I mean, that actually wasn't true. I mean, they were having a high old time.
And you cover that a bit in the early years in Hamburg.
Hello there, it's Peter. Imagine this, a picture of the four Beatles that no one has ever seen before until this week. Given the enormous and enduring popularity of the Fab Four, I think that's quite a thing, but it's what we have for you today on Travels Through Time. I've been telling you in recent weeks about our partnership with the visual historian Jordan Lloyd. Well, he's colourised a picture of the four smiling Beatles on the night of their very, very first American concert. It catches brilliant details. There's George and Ringo cigarettes. There's the flashlights of those 1960s cameras. There's this air of bedazzlement kind of written into their faces. And you can see that three out of four of them are wearing brand new coats, which is a sign of their new found wealth. You can check out this brand new image along with a full range of Jordan's work at colograph.co. That's colograph spelt the American way, C-O-L-O-R, colograph.co, where you can buy prints of Jordan's work on subjects from Mark Twain to, well, John Lennon now. They make unique and a fabulous presents. So do check out colograph.co.
Shall we move on to our third scene, or your third scene? What would you like to visit as your third and final scene in 1963?
Well, I've chosen the Texas School Book Depository, I think it was called, in Dallas in 1963, November 1963, when Lee Harvey Oswald was up there with his gun, and he shot President Kennedy dead. Once again, I'd like to be hiding behind one of the bookshelves, I think. So I wouldn't want Lee Harvey Oswald to know I was there. But I think I've chosen this also because of becoming aware of news in 1963. I remember at my first school, which is called Grove House, also near Dorking, we had a very good teacher called Miss Farrer, And I remember her teaching us about the, she almost made it into a project, the JFK assassination. So she'd put those charts up on the wall, which would show the, you know, the direction the gun was shot at and that sort of thing, and the car going along. And of course, it became the big news story of almost of the 20th century. I mean, it was hard to underrate it as a news story, and it kept going because of this, these conspiracy theories. You know, did Lee Harvey Oswald do it? Was he, if he did do it, was he alone?
Mm.
And so I thought, if I was in the book depository, I'd be able to see him doing it, and see if he was alone.
Mm.
I've always been very interested also in the conspiracies, because in a way, like we were talking about when John Lennon beat up the disc jockey and how many different versions there were just limitless, with conspiracy theories, there are limitless theories, especially with this one, you know, of who did it. And each one, even though they all contradict each other, each one has a kind of logic to it. And I think you can form any theory from any amount of random information, and you can always join the dots together, and something will come out. It's like, you know, looking at a fire or a cloud and seeing a face in it. You know, there will be a face if you, or looking at a car and seeing a face. And so I'm fascinated by that. I just read recently of, there was a man who was interviewed by the Warren Commission into the assassination, which actually I think it was a later commission. But he was basically known as, there's the famous Sapruder film where this man took sort of 30 seconds of film of the assassination, just a passerby who happened to have a camera. And this has been gone over and over again. And there was someone on the grassy knoll, which is just beside the car, the president's car, as it was passing, as he was shot. He was known as the Umbrella Man. And people really fixated, there's conspiracy theorists fixated on the Umbrella Man, because it was a very, very sunny day in Dallas, and he was the only person carrying an umbrella. And as the president's limousine approached, you can see on the film, the man of the umbrella spins his umbrella from east to west. And
so
afterwards,
ominous.
And then he sits on the sidewalk. I think there's another photograph of him sitting on the sidewalk next to another man before getting up and then walking towards the Texas School Book Depository.
Mm.
And so there were a whole lot of people who said, oh, did he fire a dart with a paralyzing agent to make the president more of a sitting duck for Lee Harvey Oswald? Or was he acting as a signaller to communicate about firing a second round if that was necessary? So all this kind of stuff. It was even in the Oliver Stone film. Anyway, in 1978, so whatever, 15 years after the assassination, a man called Louis Stephen Witt came forward. He hadn't even seen these conspiracy theories about, but he was the man with the umbrella. And the reason for this umbrella is just so interesting, I think, because it was completely bizarre. But he wanted to taunt President Kennedy, because Kennedy's father, Joe Kennedy, had been a great kind of supporter of appeasement before the Second World War, and was a great fan of Chamberlain. And Chamberlain was always portrayed as carrying an umbrella. And so there were always cartoons of Chamberlain, you know, for the anti-appeasers. Chamberlain in his umbrella was always a thing. And so this man, to taunt Joe Kennedy's son, the president, had brought an umbrella. And that was why he had it up on a sunny day. And that, you know, and that's now completely accepted as the reason. But for 15 years, it was a huge conspiracy theory. And I just think that's a fascinating kind of sideline.
Yeah. Do you think there's something unique about that particular news story that inspired so many conspiracy theories? Was it just because it was so shocking to people that somebody as charismatic as JFK could be killed so instantly, they needed to find further ways of explaining or making sense of it?
Yes, and also because basically Oswald was arrested pretty quickly after he was coming from a courtroom or from jail, I can't remember. He was then shot by this man, Jack Ruby.
Mm.
And so suddenly, you never got the resolution. He was never on trial. He never spoke. No one ever knew why he did it. if he did it, or why Jack Ruby had shot him. And so then there were lots of conspiracy theories. If Jack Ruby had been told by, say, the Mafia or Fidel Castro, you've got to shoot Oswald so he doesn't speak, or, you know, so there were, it just extended the conspiracy theory. And then, of course, Jack Ruby died of cancer eventually. And also, he was the most powerful man in the world. And as you say, very charismatic, Kennedy. And it seemed completely unthinkable. I mean, part going back to the Beatles, serious people have said that part of the unbelievable success of the Beatles 3 months later when they came to America was because this kind of the period of grieving was over and they just wanted something fresh and young and uplifting and optimistic. And I think there's a lot to be said for that in terms of the Beatles.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
Do you feel like there's anything that links those three events together, or are they random?
Well, I suppose there's a kind of link in the sort of the underdogs. Well, certainly with the great train robbers and the Beatles, you could see, you know, kind of working class heroes. And that was very much a feature of the early 60s, that, you know, up to then, the working classes had always sort of either been portrayed as butlers or servants or as sort of cheeky chappies, you know, sort of like kind of cockney comedians. And suddenly the Beatles didn't sort of go along with any of that. They were just themselves and were happy to be who they were. And so that was, and I suppose you could say the same of the great train robbers in a way. They just sort of got on with doing the business. I suppose you could say Lee Harvey Oswald was a sort of downtrodden kind of character, and he shot the most famous man in the world. I mean, I suppose you could link them in fame. You know, I mean, all these three groups of people became famous, and Mia, conceivably, one of Oswald's. He was sort of slightly, he had a weird checkered political past. He had gone to the Soviet Union and things, but he was basically a nutcase. And I'd guess that one of his motivations for shooting Kennedy was the fame that would then accrue to him, and obviously has accrued to him. The train robbers didn't want to be famous. They didn't want to be caught. But having been caught and then escaped, they quite relished. I mean, certainly Ronnie Biggs relished his fame. He even did a song with the Sex Pistols at one point.
Really?
And so, yeah, so he enjoyed his fame.
Just to complete the anti-establishment figure.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the Beatles became so famous and certainly enjoyed it up until about 1966. And then I think saw its limitations. And there's great argument. I just saw on Twitter yesterday, huge arguments about from Beatles nerds about who did the bit which goes in Day in the Life just before it goes Wake Up, God. And some people think it was Paul, and some people think it was John. And these furious arguments go on even now about whether it was Paul or John singing that little bit.
Yeah,
and it's crazy how obsessive people become about the Beatles.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they will buy your book. Yeah, you're allowed to bring one memento with you. And I just wanted to ask, what memento would you bring?
Well, I would be tempted, of course, to go to Leith Hill and scour around for the, you know, another £100,000. So I suppose those banknotes would now be not legal tender anyway. So maybe I shouldn't have that. And I do remember as a child searching Leith Hill, you know, thinking I'd find a bag of money.
Yes, I was going to say it seemed almost tantalizingly close. It would feel like writing a historical wrong if you were able to bring it back with you to the present.
I think that would be a fruitless thing. I'd just get my hands dirty for nothing. So I'd have to get something of the Beatles. I'm not a great one for choosing. Buying manuscripts. I like buying paintings, but I don't get by first editions or anything like that. Nevertheless, you know, I suppose Paul's words for yesterday, that would be exciting. I mean, they'd also be incredibly valuable. I don't know what, but they, you know, I can't remember what, but some are selling for, you know, £750,000.
Yeah.
Hey Jude, maybe it went for even more. So I suppose so because of Wimpole Street and him composing there, I'd get Yesterday, but I probably wouldn't keep it. I'd probably put it up for auction. And
really? Craig, you can't say that.
No, I know it's terrible, but but you can't. I mean, the music, the great thing about pop, you know, it's available. And so the great thing about the Beatles is their music, and everyone can hear it. It's an entirely democratic thing with records, and you don't even need to buy the record anymore. You just, you know, get it online. And so I think it's sort of silly to you know, people buying their electric guitars for £2 million or whatever. There's a doctor I mentioned in the book called Dr. Zook, who bought John Lennon's tooth of John Lennon, which John Lennon had out at the dentist and then given to his housekeeper's daughter, who was a fan. And she sold it to Dr. Zook for £17,000 in 2010. And Dr. Zook said that he was just going to take it around medical schools when he was giving lectures and that kind of thing. And in fact, recently it's emerged that his larger plan was to extract the DNA from the tooth and then advertise for people who thought they might be John Lennon's children. And they were going to sue the Lennon Ono estate and share the profits. So there are these ways you can turn.
Literally a conspiracy behind it. I think it would be quite fun, you know, the original lyrics to Yesterday when he first was trying to come up with them were scrambled eggs, oh baby, yes, how I love your legs.
Maybe I'd prefer those lyrics and the, yes, that would be more interesting to have.
That would be quite fun.
Yeah, the have the ones with scrambled eggs. Yes, because now it seems inevitable that, I mean, it's not actually one of my favourite Beatles songs or anything, but it seems inevitable that it was called Yesterday, and the tune seems to go so perfectly with the words, and that's sort of melancholy to it. But yes, he did wake up with scrambled eggs on his mind. And he also was, this is also famous, but he was also realised it was such a good tune, he couldn't believe that he hadn't stolen it from someone. So for a long time, he was just ringing around saying, have you ever heard this tune? Have you heard this tune? And then he realised it was his own. Yeah.
That must have been so exciting.
Mm, mm.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time. You indulged my 14-year-old Beatle-obsessed self a lot, so that was...
No, well, I think you know more about the Beatles than I do.
That was Craig Brown, author of 1234, The Beatles in Time. I enjoyed listening to their chat hugely, and I can guarantee that you'll enjoy the book too. It's had phenomenal reviews. Head to tttpodcast.com for more about the book, about the scenes we feature, and best of all, to see Jordan Lloyd's amazing new colourised picture of the four Beatles standing, cigarette in hand, before their first American gig. It catches a vital moment, not just in the Beatles' career, but also, I think, in 20th century culture as a whole. It's a terrific piece of work that shows a very young John, Paul, George and Ringo as they would have first been seen by all of those screaming fans. Go and check it out. This is our second week of Double Headers, and today we have another episode for you too. It's quite the contrast to 1963. It's with Professor Greg Wolfe, and he's taking my colleague Violet Moller off to visit some of the great cities of the ancient world. You can find that available on our feed right now. Nothing more really for me to add. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back with more next week. Goodbye.